it thought it would be. The future has arrived.
Welcome to the Disney Magic Podcast. I'm Joel.
And I'm Megan.
And we like to talk about Disney things. Specifically this week, we're talking about Meet the Robinsons.
Yeah.
Meet the Robinsons came out March 30th, 2007. And it was like the first one that is under the new Walt Disney Animation Studios title.
Yep, it had the little Steamboat Willie logo.
I like that logo a lot.
I like that logo too. And I like the new castle, I do.
I like the new, I mean, I like it fine, yeah. It's really pretty and really
The only thing majestic. I really miss is the little doo-wee-wee noise.
Yeah.
I really like that noise.
I know the exact noise you're talking about.
Yeah, I typed it out for myself.
Oh, good.
Which it looked like D-O-O-E-E-E, and then like seven O's. For reference, that's how you spell doo-wee-woo-woo.
Doo-wee. The noise when the castle, you know, that thing.
that thing that it does.
Meet the Robinsons was based on a book called A Day with Wilbur Robinson.
Which was features, it?
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a book.
I didn't either.
Mysterious.
But apparently it's, you know, incredibly loosely based on it.
I would not be surprised.
In that Disney. There's no time travel in the book. So
pretty much they took the kid's name and that's about it.
He made like basically there's this eccentric family and, you know, here they are. So it's a lot of like the second act bit where he's meeting all the family members.
Oh, that's my favorite bit.
That's a lot of, there's a lot of similarities to the book there, but like not much else.
That's weird.
And this is also the first movie under John Lasseter being chief creative officer.
Oh.
And so he came on like while this movie was in production.
Right.
And so that was one of his things, is he wanted to get a screening of it and decided that he didn't like the bad guy enough.
The bowler hat guy?
Well, it wasn't bowler hat guy at the time.
Oh, or it was a bowler hat?
But not the version that we know of.
Oh, because I really love bowler hat guy.
Yeah, he was...
He fixed it.
Yeah. He was pretty integral in making bowler hat guy the bowler hat guy he is today.
Awesome.
So, lots of... And the thing is, like, every, like, interview and commentary thing that I found on that his specific contribution was that... he's talking about the early cut of the film. The villain wasn't scary enough, and stuff was added, including a diabolical sidekick. And I'm like, the hat?
Yeah, Doris.
So I was like, because, you know, I don't know exactly what the original bad guy was like. And so, like, if it was just him and then the hat was added to be meaner or, you know.
I don't know.
But exactly.
He reminds me a lot of Dr. Doofenshmirtz, which is why I like him so much.
Yeah, I do really like him.
From Phineas and Ferb.
And we'll get to many examples. But I really like that I guess there's, you know, the bad guy in the Minion kind of thing is in lots... Disney movies and then just movies in general. There's this looking bad guy and this little comedic relief minion.
Yep.
And so I like that the main bad guy
was the comedic relief.
And then the little minion was the very dangerous, scary thing.
Me too.
So I really like that. And I thought it worked really well. So that's one of my favorite parts of the movie is this bad guy. So Stephen J. Anderson, who is the director of this movie, he read the screenplay and he really actively was lobbying to direct this movie because he was adopted, and so he like had this very personal connection to everything and all the questions that the movie, you know, expresses, that Lewis specifically expresses.
He Hell experienced. Yeah, adopted kids. For the record, in the context of this movie and my commentary on it, it's probably important to note that I am adopted. So I have a lot of feelings about what this movie talks about, which is probably a big reason why I love it so much.
Yeah. So when I found that out, I was like, oh, I know this is important to talk about.
That is why it has all the feels, because the guy who directed it had all those feels.
Yes. And this is that one other thing that I found in my research for the movie that isn't really relevant to anything in the movie, but for some reason, the DVD, if you get the DVD, there's a bonus feature or a bonus audio track. You know, you can get like different audio tracks of different languages or director commentary, but you can also get it with just the sound effects.
Can you really? I didn't even notice.
No music and no dialogue. Just the sound effects from the movie in 5.1 surround. Like,
that reminds me of Dr. Horrible had the subtitles in like Wiccan or something that wasn't even a language.
So I'm really curious. I could find nothing to indicate why that was an option and how they decided that they made that as an option first and then
really
decided,
determined Foley artists.
Someone was just like, these sound effects are so good.
They're the best of sound effects.
We need to have a cut of just sound effects in this movie.
I don't know. That sounds like it would be fun and terrible to watch. I feel like that would be most fun if you sat around with your friends and dubbed in voices without knowing any sort of dialogue and had all the sound effects still. That would be really nice.
But it really when the audio dub intentionally gets off track halfway through the movie, like it would really like undercut that joke.
It wouldn't make any sense at all.
So alright, but let's start up on this movie. Okay. We already talked about the opening logos,
talking about the casting and the lack of doo-woo-woo-woo.
Yep.
And the titles like right away, which is weird. I'm not used to that. Normally it's like, oh, here's a nice little scene to introduce you to the movie, and then you get the title. The title's like, nope, I'm a title. Hello.
Well, recently, we've gotten crazy, like, 7, 8, 9, 10-minute things.
Middle of the movie, they're like, oh, by the way, this is the title. Sorry.
Chicken Little was
earlier.
Like 11 minutes into that movie.
Yeah.
Into like a short movie. So it was like, you know, an eighth of the way through the movie before they're like, oh, by the way, here's what you're watching.
In case you wondered. Yeah, I thought that was odd, though, because normally there's at least, like, a little bit in.
Yeah.
But no, this was just like, hey, title time.
But, well, we get the opening scene of Lewis's mom.
I love and hate the opening scene, because, it's such a ridiculous trope. And, like, knowing the director's adapted, that's probably on purpose. To really play into like the stereotypes of adaption. There's a lady in the rain, in the dark, in the middle of the night with a baby in a cardboard box. It's not a basket. Normally it's a basket. Leaving a baby on the stoop of an orphanage. To give it up for adaption, which is like so not how adaption works at all.
With the color of the like the film different in this scene.
It's all sepia. But my favorite part was when they go back to it and it's still in sepia. That was amazing. That was totally awesome.
Yeah. Well, I was really curious, like watching this. I'm like, that when does this movie take place? Because clearly there's future in the future, and so. I found a mention of this. The future was supposed to be 2037, which is 30 years after 2007 when this movie came out. So, you know, that's very reasonable. And that's also happens to be the year in the Time Machine movie when the world, the moon breaks up in the world. So that might have been just a coincidence, or they might have been, okay, why not? So, but that, you know, tracks this scene back to like 95?
90s? Yeah. And that's not accurate.
So
especially not to how the adoption system works in America. I was adopted in the late 80s and it didn't change too much between then. Open adoptions became more common between when I was adopted and in the mid 90s. But there wasn't a whole lot of orphanages and there was definitely not a lot of leaving babies on stoops.
I mean, this is...
And there was never, ever a lot of white babies not getting adopted. Like, ever.
This is a lot... This is straight up, like, Hard Knock Life orphanage.
Yeah, it's Annie style.
So...
Yeah, so he's this healthy little white baby that mysteriously doesn't get adopted. He grows up, he's like 12, I guess.
Yeah, he's 12 because he's going to turn 13.
Right. Right, because it talks about how people don't adopt teenagers. Okay.
Yeah.
So, he's living in the orphanage and he is inventing. He's got
making stuff.
Yeah, he's got a roommate who loves baseball.
Yes, Goob.
Goob.
Lucas's roommate.
Oh, Goob.
And, oh, he had a picture of Tesla on his wall.
Did he? I didn't notice. Oh, that's awesome. Yep.
It pops up a couple of times. And so I was really pleased with that.
So, the first scene we see him in as a 12-year-old, he's inventing something. He's making a peanut butter and jelly cannon.
Gun.
Essentially, it's like
the idea is it's going to evenly distribute the peanut butter and the jelly onto your sandwich.
Which, like, in the first place, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense because the consistency of the two things is very different. Which is, like, he talks about it specifically, and I'm like, why would you think that this would work if you knew that the consistency would be an issue?
You could have, like, a really thin little jelly tube and a really thick peanut butter tube.
I guess so. I don't know. But,
I can't invent a peanut butter and jelly gun. I'm not one to talk.
I can't either. It's true. But maybe a better application for something else. I don't know what else, but something else. So he goes and has an interview with some prospective
parents,
adoptive parents. Yes. And he tries to demonstrate this to them. He's, like, really pushy about it, too.
Well, he's really excited about science and inventing things.
Yeah.
And one of the things he was really excited about inventing was moving sidewalks. And I was like, we have moving sidewalks.
Come on, kid. Where have you been?
Problem solved. And those are his examples. It was flying moving sidewalks and flying cars.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the standard and something we've taken care of.
Yep. But his peanut butter and jelly gun kind of freaks out and ends up spewing peanut butter and jelly all over the room, and the prospective adoptive father is allergic to peanuts.
Yes.
There's a lovely EpiPen scene and everything.
And to be totally fair, they had, like, a good 30 seconds to be like,
run out that door.
There's a peanut allergy in this room.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of tried. But they could have at least gotten out of the door, just, like, left.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at least she had the EpiPen.
It was a very serious peanut allergy, very clearly.
He, like, fully swelled up and everything.
Like, this wasn't any minor. This was a major, major thing. So.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this clearly did not work out for Lewis.
And he goes up on the roof, because that's where he goes when he's upset. And the orphanage lady comes to talk to him. I never caught her name, did you?
Mildred.
I liked her a lot.
Yeah.
But, like, they didn't, I don't know, we didn't get to see that much of her, but she was just a nice character.
Yeah.
She's talking to him, which I greatly enjoyed, about he makes some reference to his mother, like, leaving him, basically. And she tries to explain to him that, like, you know, maybe they were different circumstances. She doesn't go into great detail, but it's nice that that is a thought that she is suggesting.
Yeah. But Lewis makes a serious jump in logic at this point.
In my notes, it says, thank you for some birth mother niceness, and then, and a whole lot of birth mother awkwardness. Like, she's doing a really good job trying to be like, listen, this might not have been the case, and I'm sure you were well loved, and you're an awesome kid. And he's like, well, if she didn't just get rid of me, then she must still want me as a child.
Yes.
And I'm like, what?
It went from maybe she didn't give you up willingly to she is the only person who will ever love you.
Which is ridiculous. And she really did not do a good job of dissuading that. She tried a little, but she could have tried a bit harder.
I get the impression that throughout Lewis's growing up in this orphanage, her attempts to dissuade have become more and more half-hearted.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, no, so, okay.
So, okay.
All right. Go. Don't kill anybody with your explosions.
He goes to build a memory machine.
Yes.
He's trying to remember what his mother looks like, basically. Which, like, in the grand scheme of things, won't help him at all. Like,
he can start looking at people.
I guess, but, like, he lives in a city. Who's is he just going to go and look at everyone in the city? I guess he could describe her to some, but I guess you'd go to, like, a private detective for that. I don't.
I mean,
how's he going to pay somebody to find her?
I guess he could, like, show the machine and then you know, think about it and be like, she looks like this because,
yeah,
you know, that machine will show memories on the thing. But I don't, I mean, this 12-year-old kid
would be much easier.
So I don't think 12-year-old kids thoroughly have, you know, extended problem-solving plans that follow through to the end.
No.
But there's this whole montage of him building the machine and trial and error. And I really like this, and I really like that right here at the beginning, there's this keep moving forward, never give up attitude.
Yeah.
That, like, kind of we can see the beginnings of already.
Yeah.
Although, he goes through several more adoption interviews during this scene, and I'm really like, what if some of those people were nice?
They were probably lovely people. Maybe they adopted other kids. I especially like this montage because I love Rufus Wainwright, and he did the song for this montage.
Yes. So I like that there's a lot of montages in this movie, and I like all of them.
They were all really good. Yeah. Yeah. All solid montages with nice music and a good portrayal of what's going on. It's nice.
Yeah. Well montaged film. Well montaged.
Yes. Good job.
But it's time for the science fair. And yep. Well, we meet I don't remember what her name is. The caffeine patch.
Lucille.
Lucille, yes. Meet Lucille.
I love Lucille so much.
Everybody loves Lucille. But I love the coach so much.
I love the coach, too.
The coach is my absolute favorite. The coach...
with the fire ants. Oh, good.
I love the coach, and I love him making kids do laps for unsuccessful projects.
Oh, it's so perfect.
And my love for the coach is only topped by my love for Lizzie, who's this little child
yep.
who has fire ants.
It's true. I love her, too. So, in this movie... I feel like the animation hasn't changed that much in between Chicken Little and this. Like, there's still some stuff that's really off. Some stuff has definitely improved. Hair looks a lot better, and buildings look a lot better. But, like, the comedy is so much better. The pacing of this movie is so much better than Chicken Little. Like, it's... I laughed a lot while watching this movie, and I laughed maybe half a dozen times while watching Chicken Little.
Yeah. I mean, it's because this movie is its own movie, and so much of it is because it has really funny characters in it.
The characters are so, like, well put
Chicken
together.
Little had characters who were doing funny things sometimes.
But they weren't that
But the
funny.
Characters themselves weren't inherently funny. Like, each member of the family is funny all by themselves.
It's true.
So
Lucille's so funny.
I
wrote down what she shouted when they woke her up, and it's barium cobalt Einstein Kool-Aid.
Oh, good.
Just in case you wondered. Good. I love that so much.
Yeah. I really like that one of the other projects on the one of the tables was something like 3D movies, fad or favorite? And I really like it because this movie was in 3D.
Yeah. It's true. So he goes to the science fair. We meet Lucille,
yes.
who is crazy, and Lizzie's fire ant project, and the kid who built Mount Vesuvius, and there's this kid who's following Lewis.
Yes.
And he introduces himself by sneaking under the sheet that is covering his experiment. And he says his name is Wilbur Robinson, and he's a cop from the future. Yep. He's like, time cop.
Yeah, time cop. The first part of this movie is time cop.
Yep.
Which is awesome.
And
so he asks him about a bowler hat. A man in a bowler hat.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Lewis is understandably confused and concerned and fairly disinterested in this crazy kid. But then we see this man in a bowler hat.
Bowler hat guy.
Yes. And he is, basically his hat is this flying mechanical spider hat.
It's a magic hat.
Yes.
Oh, you see, Franny briefly here too.
Yes, you do see Franny briefly.
Her frost gets at loose.
Yes.
Bullet Hat Guy.
And there's some stuff in there that's really funnier the second time you see the movie.
It's so funny. It's so good. Pretty much everything the second time through this movie is even better.
Yeah.
Because there's so many little references to people and future things, and it's really nice.
Clearly, yeah. It's like, I guess I can spoil it, because we're going to spoil it at some point in this podcast. Unless you're planning on listening to half of the podcast. And then stop.
And then stopping. In which case, we apologize.
Yes. Don't do that. That's the first movie where we have to be like, spoiler alert, because we're like, we're going to spoil Cinderella, guys.
Yeah, like...
she goes to the ball.
She marries Prince Charming. Like, she loses a shoe and stuff. It's crazy.
Yes, but because there's time travel in this movie and things there are revealed.
Major plot points.
Basically, Wilbert runs into his mom at 9, and his mom says, "Don't sass me, boy," to him.
It's so cute.
It's pretty awesome.
Aww.
So, but we carry on. He starts to use his memory retriever device, but the flying bowler hat sabotages it.
Like you do. That's such a normal statement. The flying bowler hat has sabotaged the memory device.
Yep. That's the plot. That's the thing that really kicks off this movie.
Yep.
So,
And then everything goes wrong.
Yes.
Everything. The volcano erupts, and the fire ants get out, and the sprinklers go off, and everything is terrible.
And Lizzie sits there, Lizzie this creepy child, and just has this grin
on her face the whole time. Oh, she's like a tiny Wednesday Addams. It's pretty adorable.
Yes, Lindsay's my favorite.
But the coach gets fire ants all over him, and he tries to, like, scream about getting through the pain or something, like working through the pain.
Yeah, that was his thing. He was yelling at the kid doing laps, was feel the pain, love the pain, embrace the pain.
Then he just starts screaming like a lady. Oh, so good. Man.
So, clearly, Lewis is upset. His project has gone kaput, and he goes back to his roof.
Yep. And the bowler hat guy steals the machine.
Steals the machine, yes.
And Wilbur ends up on the roof.
Follows him to the roof.
I don't even know what Wilbur was trying to do. It made me laugh, but I have no idea what he was going for. He was like, so Lewis threw this piece of paper, and Wilbur threw it back, and he didn't see him. I was like, okay, that makes sense. But then Lewis threw this piece of paper, stares at Wilbur as he dashes out and throws it back at him and dashes back. And then he does it again while making bird noises.
He's pretending to be a pigeon at some point in here.
I don't know why.
But here's the thing that really threw me off in this whole scene. Behind Wilbur's head, there is, you know, there's graffiti on the roof. It's just very, like, you know, Sally loves Josh and stuff on the roof. But behind his head, there's a graffiti tic-tac-toe game that's incomplete.
Somebody stopped playing tic-tac-toe mid-game. Like, it takes, like, 3 seconds to play tic-tac-toe.
Exactly. I don't know what happened to this. I was like, oh, it's not Monopoly. It's tic-tac-toe.
It doesn't take 7 hours. It takes 5 minutes, tops. If you're, like, 5, it takes, like, 5 minutes. If you're over 5, it takes, like, 3 seconds. So I don't understand.
That incomplete tic-tac-toe really bothered me.
But, so, Lewis figures out that he's not actually Time Cop, sadly.
Yes. Because his badge was a tanning salon coupon.
It's good to know they still have tanning salons in the future.
Yes.
And he proved to him that he's traveled through time by shoving him off the roof. Onto the time machine.
He throws him.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he throws him, and he lands on this invisible time machine.
But it's like a story down or so. Like, yeah.
Well, once the machine becomes visible, we see that it was not, like, a wide machine covering this entire alley.
It's pretty small. It's, like, car-sized.
Yeah. So this is a very accurate throwing of a human body into a time machine.
Yeah.
So I'm very concerned.
He almost didn't exist.
I guess I'm not again. Now, but I would I would be.
So they go to the future.
Yes, they go to the future, and the future's awesome.
The future's so awesome. The future is Tomorrowland at Disney World / Disneyland. If you have ever been, so perfectly that it references itself.
Yes, they pointed out by having a sign that says "Today Land."
It's so good. They've got the People Mover.
Yeah.
They've got Space Mountain.
Yeah.
And everything just looks like Tomorrowland. It looks fantastic. I really love the architecture they went with for the future. It looks really nice.
It seriously, it's like one of the best possible versions of the future. So
it's exactly what I would have wanted as a child to be the future. Like, yep.
People travel bubbles. By bubble, which is awesome.
There's a really large use of bubbles, and I like bubbles.
I like the Insta building.
The Insta building was a nice touch. So,
Once Lewis realizes that, this is a time machine, he has no desire to go back and fix his memory scanner because he can literally just go back in time and find his mom. Yeah. Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. And this clashes with, plans, and they fight over the steering wheel.
And then they crash it.
They crash the time machine.
Good job.
Time machine is broken.
Meanwhile,
back in the present... I had to write that a lot in my notes to, like, try and hit the points right.
Well, first they make an agreement that Lewis is going to fix the time machine if Wilbur takes him back to see his mom.
Yes.
And then, meanwhile, back in the present.
Back in the present.
Yeah, there's a lot of time jumpy things, and in the movie it's not, like, that jarring, but in my notes it's like, oh, right. that happened in the past.
They did a really good job, like, it doesn't feel problematic in the movie.
No.
So, like, but I didn't notice until I'd see, like, I wrote Back to the Future, like, six times in these notes. And we're not even watching Back to the Future.
It's true. So the Bowler Hat Guy.
This is our first real introduction to Bowler Hat Guy.
Bowler Hat Guy.
And his personality.
And for the record, they do, in fact, call him Bowler Hat Guy most of the movie.
Yes.
We're not just calling him that because we can. That is
Bowler Hat Guy.
Actually, and what he's referring to.
But his bowler hat is named Doris.
His bowler hat is named Doris, and the IS is a 1-5.
Yes. So, he's trying to pass the invention off as his own
and sell it to a big invention producing corporation thing. I don't know.
Yes.
My favorite things about this scene are that he has a unicorn binder with one sheet of paper in it that has a checklist for what he needs to do that day.
I love that he loves checklists. He makes a point of, like, I love checklists.
He does. And also that the person who he takes the meeting from is a lady. And he goes into the meeting, and the guy who's, like, running the meeting or whatever, the president or whatever, says, I think it's Miss Johnson. I think it's her last name. And he says, actually, it's Ms. Perfect. Yeah. Perfect line. Made me laugh.
Basically, we get to see that bowler hat guy is pretty incompetent without his bowler hat.
He's so bad at everything.
And the bowler hat, Doris, is trying to give him advice through the window.
Yeah, and then he ends up, the president guy closes the blinds.
Yeah. Trying to keep the sun out of his eyes because he's squinting out the window the whole time.
Yep.
There's this thing where this giant long meeting table, like ridiculously cartoon sized meeting table.
Yep.
And so he puts the memory headphones onto the boss, and the cord stretches all the way across the table, and then the machine falls, and it falls what maybe is, 3.5-4 feet off this table. But that inertia apparently yanks this guy out of the chair and sends him flying across the room.
It does.
In defiance of physics.
He was a pretty small man. But that seems unlikely. Especially because the headphones aren't even headphones. It's a half a headphone and a CD player.
Yeah.
I don't even know why. That doesn't make any sense.
I mean, there's no real problem with it. There's enough cartoony reactions to things.
Yeah.
In this, and like bowler hat guy, his legs are comedically long.
I love bowler hat guy's proportions. It doesn't make any sense.
Like, his waist is clearly like 2 inches below his neckline.
He's like the size of a peanut with like these giant gangly spider legs and arms.
This crazy chin nose combo.
Oh, it's pretty beautiful. He really does remind me a lot of Dr. Doofenshmirtz.
Yeah,
he's kind of bumbling and similarly proportioned. They both have similar noses too.
They do. So after the fiasco and failure to sell his stolen invention, he tries to go and steal Lewis, I guess, to make him fix it. And there he runs into Goob. Which is plot important.
Plot important, Goob.
And so,
because Goob has just lost the game.
Yeah. This is the scene where I figured out that bowler hat guy and Goob were the same person. And I don't know if that was really good of me or if it was...
I don't remember. I saw this when it came out in theaters, so I don't remember exactly where I pinpointed that.
Yeah.
I think that was pretty good of you. I think that's pretty good.
Good, good, good. Yeah, pretty good of me.
Gold star for Joel.
So, but he, Goob's saying he should just, you know, let it go. Goob had been kept awake all night by Lewis trying to build his machine.
He did look really tired.
Yes, he did. I really like the animation on Goob.
I did too.
He's a cute little Goob. Bowler hat guy tells him he needs to keep that anger inside him.
Yep.
It'll keep him going and fuel his rage and his life.
Yep. And then we're back to the future again.
Yes.
We're introduced to the robot. Does the robot have a name?
The robot does have a name, but I didn't write it down.
They didn't reference it often.
No. He's mostly just the robot. This is the part where I could mostly see where, like, oh, this movie was in 3D at one point with the robot's head.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he has this really long kind of Go-Go Gadget neck thing going on.
Yep,
and so it's, like, kind of shooting towards the screen a lot.
Yep.
And this was the thing where, like, this movie was made in 3D. It wasn't a 2D movie converted into 3D. Chicken Little was. It was 2D. Chickens. And then converted into 3D, but this is a movie made for 3D from the outset. So there are stuff that you can say, like, oh, that could have been 3D, but especially the robot's head is kind of floating in front of his body the whole time.
Yeah. And this is the point where Lewis gets the fruit hat. I love the fruit hat. I don't know why they have a Carmen Miranda hat sitting around their garage, but somehow it's not that surprising to me.
But he has it for so long.
He has that hat on like half the movie.
But the eventual payoff is so good.
It's so worth it.
Like, I was like, at the beginning, I was like, this is kind of silly. This is a pretty slow pitch over the plate kind of joke. Like, oh, fruit hat.
No.
But then, like, it
just keeps getting awesome. Oh.
So, that was commitment, and I applaud the commitment and confidence.
I applaud whoever had to animate all those fruit all the time. That's a lot of fruit. So
I do really like, there's this scene where basically Lewis is telling Lewis to stay.
Yeah.
And he has this pipe teleportation implement in the
That's
house.
That's so good. And he just keeps moving back and forth to tell him things really fast. It's really funny.
So... I really like Wilbur. I think that was just like an incredibly well developed character.
Yeah, and I like them as friends.
Yeah.
They work really well as a pair.
Yeah.
I like everybody in this movie. There's not a character I dislike, I don't think.
No. I like a lot. Lizzie's my favorite, but I like a lot.
I like pretty much everybody.
But yeah, this is the scene where basically everybody is introduced.
Yeah. Of course, after telling him to stay put, he just leaves immediately.
To be fair, he gets sucked up a tooth.
Yeah.
He doesn't, like,
it's
go out.
It's kind of accidental, but mostly I think he just wanted to see how it worked. And so the first people we meet are the guys in the flower pots.
Yes.
I don't remember. I remember some people's names, and some people's, like, really
Uncle
don't.
Something.
There's a bunch of uncles and aunts.
Yes. Uncle Spike, I think. Dimitri and Spike.
Dimitri and Spike, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Good for you. So
I remembered an S, and I had to, like, figure it out. They are,
Yeah.
They're the ring the doorbell.
Yeah.
Which results.
And then there's the octopus,
mm-hmm.
who's their butler.
Yes.
We later learn. I don't remember his name, though. Then we meet Bud, who is the grandpa. He's got a face drawn on the back of his head. because that's the kind of guy he is.
Yes.
And he takes him around.
Which basically, yeah, is the big introduction. He tries to find the garage.
I
do not remember the order.
My favorite thing about Bud, though, is when he introduces himself and he says, "I don't remember." He says, "I don't remember something," and then he said, "I also don't remember that there's a woodchuck on my arm." But there he is. And he holds up his arm, and there's this like woodchuck attached to his arm, and he just says something like, "Hope he ain't got rabies." Meet the Robinsons. Why are you so weird? This movie is so weird and so delightful. Okay, so.
Pretty crazy pants.
Next, they go visit the twins. Wait, no, okay. Not the twins. The lady with the train and the guy with the cannon. They're not twins. I don't know why I thought
no,
twins.
No, they are. The cannon is Franny's brother.
Right. And Aunt Billy. I don't remember how Aunt Billy's
I don't remember.
But
here's the thing. With this all comes at rapid pace.
It's really fast.
With like 2 to 3 jokes per character.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of like laughing over important information.
Yeah.
And then they go through the whole family tree again with brand new jokes per character.
It's true. So I just don't. I didn't quite process the names. I don't even think it matters that we did. But no. That's okay.
There's the girl who plays the train. The meatball cannon.
And then there's Joe, who works out a lot. He's in, like, the chair, watching TV all the time.
Uncle Joe.
And then there's Uncle Art.
Then the twins.
Do we get the twins first, or do we get the superhero pizza?
I don't know. We get a superhero pizza, because that was Adam West.
He's voiced by Adam West, yes. Which was
Adam West
awesome.
Has 2 in a row.
It's true. Maybe he'll be in every movie ever now.
I don't know, like... My first thought was like, I bet that's the first time. And I was like, I know it's not the first time because Patrick Warburton was in Home on the Range and then Chicken Little.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm willing to bet that some people, like, especially in the early ones.
Yeah.
Like some people who do recurring voices.
Yeah.
Probably had a bunch in a row.
Especially like small, big characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Additional voices people.
Yeah. So... Adam West is a superhero pizza delivery guy.
Yeah.
I liked his character a lot. later in the movie, he shoots cheese. then we get the twins, I think. We're both voiced by the same dude, which I thought was really funny. So they sounded alike, but the lady sounded like a dude. And they're fighting with paint or something. I don't know. There's Lucille, who's making cookies. She's just dancing. I don't know. I like that shot a lot. It makes me laugh.
Here's the thing about this whole sequence. Because there are so many jokes, like some of them work better than others, but because there are so many... Like,
the whole time I was laughing.
Yeah, it works perfectly fine.
Yeah. Lefty. So. Lefty is the octopus.
Lefty is the octopus. You're right.
It's in my notes later on because I guess they're introducing people.
Yeah, when they introduce him.
And then finally Franny. And her singing frogs. Yes. I love Franny.
I love her immensely.
She seems like the nicest mom. Of all the Disney parents, I think I'd like Franny and Cornelius, thanks. But the singing frogs are fantastic. I love the singing frogs so much. They're like Rat Pack Mafia.
Yeah, they're Frank's out. And the frog is named Frankie.
He's named Frankie. Oh, God, it only gets better, too.
Yeah.
There's so many nice little Mafia references. So then we get the whole family tree.
Again.
And my favorite, though, is Tom Selleck.
It has to be Tom Selleck, right?
yeah, that's my favorite, is that they're going through the family tree and...
They're going through with
Lewis,
portraits.
Yeah, Lewis asks what Cornelius looks like, his dad, Wilbur's dad.
Yeah.
And he says he looks like Tom Selleck. It's because he's voiced by Tom Selleck. It's so perfect. But it makes me laugh so much. I don't know why. It makes me laugh so hard. Just like the way they animated, like putting the portrait of Tom Selleck there. I just laughed for like 3 minutes straight. I had to like pause the movie.
Yeah. That was like one of my favorite jokes the first time I watched this.
It's Tom Selleck.
And like watching this, I was like, oh, the Tom Selleck joke's coming. I'm
so
excited.
So much. Then we get back to the past.
This is where we split up and search for clues. And so Bowler Hat Guy successfully finds a stick.
Yep.
And Doris has found, like, DNA evidence.
She's found DNA evidence of Lewis and Wilbur and next to residue.
Time travel residue
from a spaceship. Like, oh, well then. And he's like, with your DNA and residue and with my stick, that means. He's so perfect.
I really like him.
Yep.
He was. And so they head back to the future.
Yes.
And this is where we learned about Cornelius, about his dad's basically life story.
Yeah.
Which involves, you know, going up, building a lot of stuff, becoming a famous inventor. That all leads to time machine inventions.
Yes.
Which is, you know, important and wonderful, but now time, one's missing and one's broken, and Lewis has to fix one.
Yes.
And so, this is also, I guess, the introduction of Keep Moving Forward.
Yes.
Which is the slogan of the movie and of
the company.
Yeah.
And his, like, personal motto.
Yeah.
Actually, he loses the fruit hat in this scene, and I forgot to mention that my favorite fruit hat joke was that he played like maracas full on Carmen Miranda style.
Yes.
with the frog band. So
I love that because Wilbur's his whole character is a very fast talker and quick, rapid. And he has to stop right in the middle of the spiel to be like, wait a minute, you're still wearing that fruit hat. I cannot take you seriously.
So good.
Gives him and another hat. Rapid cuts. And yeah. He's wearing a baseball cap and they're right back into exposition.
It's so good. And next is dinner time, I guess.
Yeah. He can't fix the machine. The time machine starts up and breaks down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then they're called up to dinner.
In the meantime, bowler hat guy gets a mini Doris to pilot.
Yes.
Because Doris just, like, pops it out. Just, like, it makes, like, a popping noise, and there's a smaller Doris. I cannot quite wrap my brain around that, but I'm just gonna go with it, because it works for the movie.
For bowler hat guy to control.
Yep.
This is the point where bowler hat guy is trying to figure out what to do with Lewis. And his first plan is to blow him up.
That won't work.
And then he'll turn him into a duck. But that won't work because he doesn't know how to do that. Plus, he doesn't need a duck.
He doesn't need a duck. I love that was his reasoning. Not because, like, that doesn't make any sense. I don't need a duck.
So, I really like that.
They kind of split up and try and find ways to, like, do him in, basically.
Yeah.
Well, capture him. They're trying to capture him, but they're doing a whole lot of almost killing him.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know what Doris's plan is. Doris was, like, about to drop a chandelier on him.
I know. Like, how is this going to work in your favor? So, they're eating spaghetti, and the meatballs in the scene look really bad. This is the only animation that really bothered me this whole movie, was the meatballs looked really, like, not good. They look really gross.
Well, they're about to, you know, like, turn into weaponry.
But then I remember I watched the commentary on The Incredibles once, and they spent a good 20 minutes talking about how hard it was to animate their dinner. And so I was like, you know what? The meatballs are fine. I don't even care. Because I remember them talking, ranting angrily about broccoli in The Incredibles commentary and how hard it was to keep it on the damn plate. So,
and that's all it had to do. This is, like, really intricate meatball choreography. Yes.
So my favorite thing about this scene is that Canada is no longer Canada. Instead, it is North Montana.
I like that, but I like that later in the movie, Adam West, pizza delivery guy, mentions that a true North Montana man would never care about bad hair.
It's so funny. Oh, everything about North Montana is funny in this scene. Franny and her brother, the cannon guy, I don't remember his name, have a full-on karate meatball fight.
Yes. And this is where the dubbing gets off-kilter intentionally.
Yes.
Intentionally off-kilter to basically make a, you know, old Japanese martial arts showdown.
Yep. Which is the only reason that redubbing this with just the sound effects, apparently, would not be as fun because this the scene would be not as fun. So after the karate fight, which Franny wins, the robot comes out and decides that nothing goes better with spaghetti and meatballs than peanut butter and jelly. And he's got the little peanut butter and jelly gun. And this is like your first inclination that Cornelius is Lewis, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know that I really connected that the first time seeing it, but it's nice seeing it again and being like, yeah, that's one, peanut butter and jelly gun. Yeah.
See, this is something, I figured this out like pretty quickly as soon as like, my dad's not here. And I was like, well, I know how this is going to end.
Well, Joel, you are much more savvy at time travel movies than I am, apparently.
Apparently so. I was not impressed at my quick figure out on this one as I was on Goob.
Yeah, so. You were pretty good on Goob. The machine is stuck, but Uncle Joe already has toast, and Uncle Joe's gonna go postal if he doesn't get peanut butter and jelly soon, which I thought was really like random but delightful.
I couldn't figure out if it was because he doesn't like toast. And this is how you secretly feed him toast. Like when you, like, can't feed a kid a muffin, so you're like, it's a cupcake.
Do kids not like muffins?
I don't know. Not as much as they like cupcakes.
I suppose so. I would say that nobody really likes muffins as much as they like cupcakes. Because, you know, cupcakes are inherently better because they got frosting. But that's beside the point. I don't know. I think it's because once he sees food, if it's not complete immediately, he's just really impatient, maybe.
I don't know. So Lewis is trying to fix the peanut butter and jelly gun.
Yeah.
And meanwhile...
The frogs at their little bar!
Yes.
The frogs have a Rat Pack bar. And it's fabulous. And Frankie's telling them some probably dirty but off-screen joke.
Yes.
And
something where we can hear just the punchline.
There's a little like machine that doles out flies, and they're drinking martinis, and it's just they're in little suits. I love everything about the frogs.
Yeah.
So perfect.
Yeah. I really like the frogs. And so bowler hat guy takes his little tiny remote control bowler hat
and puts it on Frankie.
Yep, puts it on him, and so he commands his talking frog to go and grab Lewis.
Yep, and he gets into the dining room, and Lewis is like messing with the machine or whatever, and he's just like, well, it's just that there are a million people over there, and I have little arms, and I'm not sure that you thought this whole thing through. Which is almost exactly referenced in the dinosaur.
Yeah, this is like the favorite joke of the world from this movie.
I like
is, this, is the this tiny joke. Arms.
Tiny arms. So Lewis fails miserably at fixing it, and he's like really frustrated with himself, and everybody's like really excited about it. I thought that was so cute. That they just entirely failed. And he was like super excited.
I really like how consistent that is for Lewis, this frustration.
Yeah.
And that he's a 12-year-old kid. And like,
and that's really annoying to a 12-year-old kid. Yeah.
And just, like, as a whole, he felt like such a complete person. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, we can see this genuine excitement for science and this persistence when he's making the memory machine. And at the same time, there's this frustration with constant failure and these things not working. And I was just really impressed at how well the movie as a whole balances all that.
Yeah, I really like how like consistently frustrating it is for him. It's not like a random thing at the end of the movie and just be like, oh, and he's having a hard time. Like, he consistently has problems with his inventions working or fixing things that doesn't work that really adds up in the end, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bowler hat guy gets the dinosaur idea.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they have topiaries outside shaped like dinosaurs.
Of large dinosaurs.
Because that makes sense.
I mean, if I were a wealthy inventor who had invented everything in the world.
Yep.
Why not?
And there's a point in here where Doris is trying to cut down the chandelier. And they're having a conversation about how Lewis is an orphan, which is an awkward thing to have a conversation about over dinner with somebody you barely know, but okay. And you can immediately see Franny make that recognition that she's very familiar with this sort of situation, which I think is really nice.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure she's heard.
So you have this tender moment with the family.
And then there's a dinosaur.
Yes.
So the dinosaur, there's this big chase scene with the dinosaur where everybody gets out to help, which I really like.
Yeah, I really like the dinosaur. I really liked how invested... I mean, clearly you're going to be invested in the dinosaur attacking your house.
But they were all really willing to defend, which is nice.
Yeah.
In their own special ways, like with a train or with a pizza shooting,
saucer flying.
Was it shooting cheese or was it shooting dough?
I think it was dough.
Was it dough? I thought it was cheese.
I think it was dough because they deep dished the dinosaur.
Yeah, I did like that little joke. Yeah. I love the dinosaur. Then the dinosaur goes after them, and he's in like this little awkward corner of the house, and the dinosaur can't get to him because he's got a big head and little arms.
His plan was not well thought out. Yep. Recurring little arms joke.
Yep. And the bowler hat gets knocked off.
Yeah, by the greatest trajectory shooting from a meatball in the history of cinema.
It was pretty perfect.
Like, he clearly had some sort of advanced calculus trigonometry thing going on here.
Yep.
To be able to calculate an angle like that.
Yep. And, or either that or he's played a lot of bubble shooter games on the internet.
Or that.
Those are your options. My favorite thing, though, is that the frogs get a hold of Tiny Doris and they bring her to the trunk of this, like, characteristic mafia-looking car, and, like, they throw her in the trunk and it's got, like, a shovel and a tire in it.
The license plate on the car is Ribbit, RIB-IT.
Yep, it's so perfect. I love that little joke. It's so good.
Well done, Mafia Frogs.
And,
So this is where
this whole situation, like, every single line for the next, like, three or four lines that I wrote in my notes has awkward on the end of it. Everything's so awkward. It's so awkward.
It is.
So they offer to adopt Lewis, which is very sweet and very sudden, and also very awkward. Wilbur, like, tries to convince them otherwise, and then he just, like, gives up and knocks his hat off, and they all, like, freak out, and Lewis is like, is my hair a problem? Like, he really still has no idea what's going on.
The thing is, he has this, you know, really well-defined, distinguishable hair.
Yeah.
And clearly Cornelius has the same hair.
Yeah.
So, like, everybody immediately is like, well, this kid clearly has to go back to the past.
Yep.
And so I'm really curious what would have happened if he was just another kid from the past.
I don't know, because wouldn't that be a problem? Like, timeline-wise?
I don't know. I don't know how committed to timeline stuff the movie is, because, you know, like, the whole point, you know, the whole movie's kicked off because Goob misses a baseball.
Yeah.
And then Goob catches baseball at the end.
So I think that would have been bad. I think something terrible probably would have happened. Or at least something very different.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then Wilbur reveals that he was never going to take Lewis back to see his birth mother, which is also really awkward. There's this whole, it's so awkward. Everything's awkward in this scene. It's basically just like, oh, never mind. Okay, bye.
It's a difficult scene to get through.
Yeah. And I feel bad for everyone in this scene.
Yeah.
Except for Wilbur, who did everything wrong. But that's okay.
He did everything wrong, but he genuinely had the best of intentions.
Well, kind of. I mean, he did, like, leave the garage door open like an idiot and try and go get it. And he's, like, 13, and that's a terrible plan. But, like, the thing is that if he hadn't been such a well-constructed, likable character, I really would not have liked Wilbur, because he did do all these things wrong and then doesn't really get punished for it in the end. I mean, they say he's grounded forever.
He's grounded till he dies.
But that seems unlikely, especially in their family. How would he stay grounded if nobody can find the garage? Like, that doesn't even make sense. So
I don't know. You're grounded. You have to be in the normal people room.
You have to be in a room that we're in pretty frequently so we can know that you're there, because otherwise you might just disappear on us. But he doesn't really receive a lot of consequences. So I was glad that the character was so well constructed so that I could still enjoy him as a character.
It's very clear he has the best of intentions. Like,
he's trying.
He's not in this for himself. Like, you know, no, I guess he doesn't want to get in trouble for leaving the garage open.
Yeah.
But after
this situation, so he hard. Clearly, like, cares.
Yeah. But currently they're fighting, and Lewis runs away.
Lewis storms off to the topiaries shaped like a tea party. You know. he goes with the bowler hat guy. Because the bowler hat guy. He offers to trade him a fixed machine for going back to see his birth mother and going back to his own time.
Yeah. But he crosses his fingers behind his back.
Scandalous. He fixes the machine for him, the memory reading machine, that is.
Yes, because he still wants to patent that with Inventi Company.
Inventi Corp.
Yeah.
That's what I'm naming it right now. It doesn't have a name. It's going to be Inventi Corp.
It did have a name. It was emblazoned in giant letters across that building.
I thought it just had, like, a light bulb.
So, I don't know.
It's Inventi Corp now. I've decided.
This scene, this where he basically shows him how to work the machine, and then he reveals that he's Goob, and he talks about his life between being Goob and being Bowler Hat Guy.
This scene is so weird. Oh, and he realizes that he's Wilbur's dad at this point.
Yes, yeah. There's
some talk of that.
This, my favorite part in the entire movie, is where he's dropped the ball and he's walking around being sullen about it, and he walks through the halls of his school. This one goes, "Hey, cool binder." Another goes, "Hey, Goob, want to come over to my house today?" And
then everyone hated me.
They all hated me.
It was so perfect. Oh, it was so good.
That is my favorite part of this whole movie, that one little thing.
Oh, yep.
But I really liked, they had this, like, passing of time scene. So the setup, basically, for this character is really kind of creepy when you start to think about it.
He's really eerie.
Because, like, the orphanage closed down and everybody left except for him. Stayed. And he just kept, like, living in this orphanage.
He was young at the time, too. It looked like he was maybe, like, 10. Yep. Like, they just abandoned this 10-year-old. What?
And he, like, just stays in this room listening to the radio.
He still has his baseball uniform on.
Wearing that baseball uniform. Yeah.
So creepy.
So it's really creepy. But I really liked seeing the progression from Goob to Bowler Hat Guy.
Yeah, because the two characters
really look nothing alike.
Yeah,
but each little, you know, each step in between looked like both the step before and the step after it. Yeah. So, like,
these
stepping stones really worked out. So I really like that, and I really, really like, you know, just all the younger to older characters in this movie. You know, we see Franny in both directions, and we see Lewis, and so I really liked.
They were all very convincing.
Yeah, the thing where they look different. They don't look like bigger versions of themselves, but you can definitely see how one would age into the other.
Yeah. I really like that a lot. Because a lot of times in cartoons, even in, like, more recent cartoons, like, Rapunzel looks like tiny Rapunzel and then older Rapunzel. Like, there's not a lot of change there, but they age really realistically in this movie where you can see how they kind of, like, progressed in age and they look realistically different, but still the same people. I really like that. It also has a little backstory about Doris.
Doris.
Who pulls a HAL 9000.
Yeah. Doris was an envision.
Complete with changing eye color. It's nice.
Yes.
She was the helping hat? Helping hands?
Helping hat. The helping hat. That I just decided it could be controlled you and was basically wanted to make zombies.
But she was invented by Cornelius. So.
And so this is where Wilbur and the robot save Lewis.
Yep.
But not the invention, basically.
Yeah. And then that doesn't work out so well. Because they harpoon the robot.
Yeah.
That was really disturbing. Like,
it was. And the thing is, like, this is one of the longer movies we've seen.
Yeah.
And so this point is a point where we're like, would be the climax of a shorter movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, because it's like, you know, the darkest, you know, reveal has happened, and like, then they've come in and they've saved Lewis and they're running and sprinting. So, like, you can say, like, oh, quick little, you know, fight and it's over. Here we go. But then it's like,
there's so much more.
Dead robots.
Yeah. So, then they manage to get back to the garage, and Wilbur, like, disappears.
Yeah, then we get darkest timeline. He's not born, basically.
Yeah. Except for nobody has goatees. Sad.
Nobody has goatees, but everybody has hats.
Everybody has hats.
To make up for the lack of goatee.
Okay, what I didn't understand about this scene is he's fixing the time machine.
Yes.
But I don't understand why the time machine is still there when everything else is gone, pretty much.
I mean, yeah, the movie doesn't delve too deep into alternate timeline plans. I would be happy to live with some sort of, like, once you've made a time machine that can freely travel within and out of time.
It doesn't change, I guess?
Yeah, it's not bound by the confines of alternate timelines.
I guess that would make sense.
Once a time machine, always a time machine kind of thing.
But he's fixing it, and everyone's got, the helping hats have taken over everything, and they're all the zombie helping hat people. That was weird. That was creepy.
Yeah.
But he fixes the time machine while falling off a cliff, of course.
He, like, it's a good thing he was only, like, 3 wires away from fixing that time machine.
I know, right? So.
But then he doesn't use the time machine as a time machine.
No.
He uses it as a flying car.
Yep.
For, like, 10 minutes.
Yep.
Oh, my notes, my next 3 notes are just, go back in time. Dude, back
in
time.
Right?
Go back in time.
So there's a giant hat. He was inside the giant hat, which was odd. And then
their house is a giant hat. So, like, everything turns into bowler hats all throughout the land.
There's this big chase scene, and he finally goes back in time. And he fixes the meeting. He talks to Goob.
He basically stops there.
Explains that Doris is evil and shows him the future.
And he wins by just being like, I'm not going to invent Doris. And so because he's, like, declared that, Doris disappears. Which, you know, really kind of easy cop-out, but I really liked anyway.
I was totally fine with it. I don't know why. I guess it just seemed like it made kind of sense. Like, if he knew not to invent that, he wouldn't, so.
Yeah.
I guess that works, but I don't understand why he would have to state that openly. But okay, he's good.
It's just to be declarative. It's, you know, successfully be triumphant.
And he shows Goob the future, and it's all fixed with bubbles, because bubbles.
Yes. I do like the transition back into...
I love bubbles.
Nice timeline.
And they land in the future, and everything's better, and Wilbur's back.
Yeah.
And they offer to adopt Goob, but he ran off.
And that's the end of Goob.
Yeah, we don't really get more backstory.
Like, no, he does not really get...
They find his binder, and it's just got an extra box on his checklist that just says ?
Which is really, really interesting to...
Yeah. Well, you know. I mean, he fixes the baseball game eventually.
Yeah.
So I guess he's not, like, crazy anymore. But, like, we don't know what happened to him after that.
We don't know. We don't
Maybe
know
he's
what
a baseball
happened
star.
To Darkest Timeline Goob.
I don't know.
You know, to this particular... version of him.
It's kind of nice, to have an open-ended villain.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It's
I really liked it.
Yeah, because most Disney villains plummet to their deaths.
Yeah, lots of falling.
You know, lots of falling off cliffs.
But especially because he is, you know, this misunderstood villain, essentially. You know.
Yeah.
He has this motive that's very minimal. He doesn't really have world conquest thing. And so to leave it ending with, you know, not to just have him leave, but to, like, actually make the point of, like, have the question mark and the what's next and the what do I do to my life kind of thing.
That's nice.
Yeah. So I really, really like that. Like, it's a little deep for a Disney movie.
Yeah, seriously.
There.
It was nice, though. It was
And, like, the more
nice.
You think about it, you're like, oh, man, question mark
That's
equals
so
life.
Deep.
Oh, man.
Yep.
But, like, yeah, it's really good.
So, that Cornelius shows up.
Yeah, there's a lot of
Franny's
there's a
called
lot of
him
like
basically to be like, what is wrong?
There's a lot of, I guess, closure in this movie. There's a lot of follow-up after the climax, after beating the bad guy.
Yeah, there is.
There's some talking to Cornelius.
And he
gets to go see his study.
That's really cool, his lab. Mm-hmm. I love that he said he's most proud of the memory retrieval machine. And he keeps it under a sheet. I'm most proud of that one. That one over there, underneath the blanket, behind the corner of the other machine. It's cool.
Yep, in the corner, behind that other machine.
That one's my favorite. I mean, I guess he kept it in his lab. Yeah. Which is more than we can say from the other ones that are all little glass things.
Those are the rejected ones.
Yeah. And there's more iterations of Keep Moving Forward. And they have to say goodbye.
Says bye to the family.
Sad.
And I really liked this kind of relationship between Wilbur and Lewis, and it kind of comes to an end here, which is really nice.
Also, they kept the dinosaur as a pet. That made me happy.
I did like the dinosaur in the background. Just being dinosaur pet.
Dinosaur.
So I guess they can't keep some stuff from the past.
Apparently. But then Wilbur takes him back, and he takes him to sepia times.
Yes.
to see his birth mother, because he promised.
The ancient past of 95.
But I liked that he did actually keep his promise. That was nice.
Yeah.
This is my favorite part of his movie. Honestly, my favorite part.
Because he doesn't
talk to his birth mother. So I had a closed adoption, which means that I don't know who my birth parents are. And I've never really had the need or desire to meet my birth parents, which a lot of people think is very weird, but I'm happy with how my life is, and I just it's not that I don't care. I just have no driving desire to meet them. So it was really nice to me that he felt secure in the fact that he was going to have this wonderful family, that he didn't need that sort of interaction to be happy. Because so often in movies about adopted kids, it's always like, I don't fit in with this family. And they run off and find their birth parents and everything is fine, which is weird. So it was nice to have a similar perspective to mine seen in a movie.
I mean, I understand, when, an adopted kid is part of your movie, to be like, here's a happy, well-adjusted person who loves their life.
Yeah.
There's no conflict in that movie.
That's true.
So, I understand that, but it's really nice that this movie is about making your family. It's family is what's present.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Family is what you make it, which is really, really nice. Because that is not how adopted stories work in movies ever at all. I cried during the scene, and then I cried at the end. I cried twice. I was just like, nope, crying everywhere. He doesn't meet his birth mother. And he
doesn't use the memory. He uses it to see his eventual adopted mother's wedding.
Her wedding day.
It's a nice little symbolism to me that, he was trying to build the machine to see his mom, and then he did see his mom in the machine.
That made me happy. He fixes the baseball game first, though.
Yes, he does.
He just yells at Goom to wake him up. Then he catches the ball and he wins. But when he asks to see Lucille's, Lucille offers to volunteer to see her memory, and she lists a bunch of stuff. My favorite thing was my first gold medal for the luge. Yeah. Lucille has more than one gold medal in the luge, apparently. So that's good.
She's an accomplished woman. Caffeine patches.
Yep. Her wedding day. That was really cute. Yep. Bud comes to pick her up, I guess.
Yes.
Bud.
Yeah, because she mentions her ride's not there yet.
Yeah. So he meets Bud in his young form. Still with the backwards.
Still with the backwards. This man is committed to this joke.
Yep.
He's living the joke.
Yep. Lewis realizes who Franny is with her singing frogs. And there's a guy from the local paper who comes out of nowhere. There's no reason for this guy to be there. But he
even has, like, local paper accent. Says, hey, kid, yep. Make a story out of you.
Yeah, and he seems to know what has just happened mysteriously. Like, come looking for it, which is weird.
I guess large explosion at local science fair might actually make a nice little story.
Yeah, that's true. Lewis gets adopted by Lucille and Bud, and they move into an observatory, which I thought was cool because that's the house they live in. Eventually,
we also get this, this quick little, you know, implication that Goob is about to be adopted.
Yeah,
he's not obsessive.
He's talking to some people about how he won the game, which is cute.
Yeah.
But they move into this observatory and they set up the lab, and then there's a nice little time lapse of him like filling up the lab.
Really bad for Lucille and Bud because they were like covering his eyes to be really excited about getting to see his lab. Like, he's seen this. He's totally seen this lab.
He's still excited. Shut up.
He is. He's appropriately excited, but I'm like, he's not going to be surprised. He knows exactly what it looked like.
It's true. And then they have a nice hug, and then I cried some more. I'm really emotional about this movie, you guys.
Yeah. He's building stuff. You can see the beginnings of the robot in what he's building. And you can see some rocket boots, which were from an earlier draft where he was going to have a rocket boot fight with Doris.
Oh, that's it. Nice.
So,
And then it's the quote from Walt Disney.
The quote from Walt
that
Disney.
That they got keep moving forward from. He was in particular, I think, referencing Disneyland there when he was talking about, like, redoing rides or whatever. And he was saying that, you know, they don't tend to dwell on the past. They keep moving forward.
Yeah. It's a really great quote.
It is a really nice choice of quote. I really like that.
So, I'm usually one to get kind of cynical about like quotes. I'm like, nice pandering movie, but this time I was like, that was really nice.
Because like when I first saw this movie, I didn't recognize the reference. I knew the quote. I had seen it before, but I didn't connect throughout the movie. So to see the Walt Disney quote at the end, I was like, that's nice, you guys.
And it's really nice, which, you know, I don't know how intentional it was, but, like, we've just come off of, like, a slew of movies that I didn't really care for as much as
others. And this one's good.
And this is good. And we're, like, it's, like, kicking back into this, you know, little upswing again that's hopefully just going to keep going onward.
Fingers crossed.
And so I like this, like, you know, not dwelling on the past kind of thing.
Yeah. It's nice.
So, yeah. I really liked that.
As you can probably tell, I love this movie. It's a really well-constructed movie, I think, especially in comparison to previous ones. And I think it doesn't get as much credit as it should for how good it is. I don't think it... Did it do poorly in the box office? Was that part of the reason?
It was... I remember it was like the fourth highest-grossing animated movie of that year.
Ooh.
Which is like...
Not good.
Which, you know, isn't... That, I mean, it was...
It's not terrible.
2007 was Ratatouille.
Oh.
And the Simpsons movie came out that year, which probably beat it.
Yeah.
And Shrek the Third, I think, came out that year.
Yeah.
Which probably beat it. Which,
probably.
Yeah,
it did.
Quality-wise or not, whatever you care about, Shrek
it
the Third.
Yeah,
it probably beat it in the thing.
Yeah.
So not terrible. Yeah.
But not great either. Like, I know a lot of people who haven't seen this movie. So, I don't know. I really enjoy it. I think it's really funny, like, consistently funny. And I really love the characters. The characters are all so likable and so well-constructed. The animation is not my favorite, but it isn't terrible either. Like, it's much better than Chicken Little was, so they're getting it. And I'm sure with Bolt, we will see an obvious progression there.
It's a movie where, especially coming off of Chicken Little, it's a movie that, you know, it feels like they're trying to make, I don't want to say make good movies, because, like, there's a lot of DreamWorks movies that I do like, and I think DreamWorks makes really good movies really well, but I think that a lot of what made this movie so good was a much clearer passion from the creators.
Yeah, definitely.
In making a good movie, and then making this movie in particular.
Yeah.
That this was a story they wanted to tell. Whereas you know, to an early extent, some of the movies that we've seen before is just like, let's make a movie now. Okay. Got to make it like this. Here we go.
I feel like this movie is the first movie in this lineup since the Renaissance that was really not just trying to replicate what happened in the Renaissance. You know, it wasn't like a fairy tale sort of thing. There was no like romance involved. It didn't feel like, oh, we're trying to recapture what The Lion King did and what Beauty and the Beast did. It felt like it was trying to be its own thing and doing it well, while still maintaining quite a lot of Disney to it.
Yeah. So, well done.
I like it.
It's a good one. And it's just like a big, like, breathe easy now. Okay.
From here on out, it's going to be all right, you guys.
Keep moving forward.
Yep.
All right. That was Meet the Robinsons. And next week is going to be Bolt.
So, I haven't seen this one. This is the last one I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm. Last one you haven't seen? I've seen Bolt. I really like Bolt, but it has a dog in it, which means I'm going to cry.
It's true. So, automatic crying.
Yep. I did really like Bolt.
I'm excited to watch it. I've heard good things.
I was like really prepared to not like it at the time. So it was, it was like a really refreshing, like, because it was, you know, there was a lot of, at the time, you know, this one, we said like before, the past couple of ones that I was watching for the first time doing this, and then even Meet the Robinsons I'd seen before, but I didn't see it in theaters. I saw it way, way later, and I might have actually seen After Bolt. So Bolt was like the first Disney movie is out. I need to go see this Disney movie.
Yeah.
To happen in a long, long time. So, yeah, it was good. All right. Next week, Bolt.
Yep.
Until then, bye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Time falls away.